By a vector field, how does the metric transform? This.
This is gonna be like psi kappa g mu comma kappa.
Kappa. What is kappa?
That's some new index, right? Like I have to introduce a new index.
No. Okay. No. Okay, depends how you want to write. There's a way of writing it more covariantly. You know, there's a way to write it that's more covariant.
So I can take like nabla.
Zi. Yeah. Okay. So it's nabla mu this, right?
Yeah.
Are you happy with that?
Plus.
Plus. It has to be symmetric. So yeah. So that's how a metric transforms into a diffeomorphism. So a conformal transformation, as defined this way, is a diffeo that can be undone by a wild transformation. So a wild transformation is a transformation that infinitesimally acts by just rescaling the metric. OK? And you can see that if I take delta zeta g mu nu, and now I demand that I only consider those diffeos that can be killed by a wild transformation, that the equation you get is precisely the conformal killing vector equation. So there are several ways to think about things. That's one way, yeah. Now, one mistake one should not do, the very common mistake, is that, of course, we're doing physics with a fixed metric. We're doing field theory. The thing you should not do is transform at the same time the metric and the coordinates. Why? Because if you change the metric and the coordinates, what happens to the line element? Doesn't change. So in physics, you always transform things that are dynamical. The metric is not dynamical here. The metric is a background. What we transform are the fields that depend on the coordinates. So just be careful that you don't do, if you transform everything, you haven't done anything. It's kind of an empty statement. OK. Hope that clarified this. Any other questions? OK, so let me go quickly through this. There's a lot of stuff to do today. So in the last lecture, we essentially solved this equation that defines the infinitesimal conformal transformations, those connected to the identity. It's generated by this vector field. And to each of the parameters in the vector field, we associated a generator. And we discussed what Lie algebra they generate. And it generates a Lie algebra that you're very familiar with, which is the orthogonal Lie algebra, with the peculiarity that it has two time-like and d minus, and d space-like components. You're familiar with SOD from rotations of the sphere, but also with Minkowski space, which is SO1, comma d. This has an extra time-like component. Okay, that you can think of as arising from the non-compactness of the dilatation operator. This is a non-compact. Lambda is compact. Non-compact. Okay. Okay. I'll say a few things now about. I just want to wrap up this before we move into. This is all geometry and kinematics. We want to do physics, so in order to understand physics, we want to understand what consequences having this symmetry has on your theory. So the one I want to discuss is that there is a discrete, an important discrete conformal transformation that's not connected to the identity. It's called inversion. So I call it by the name I. That maps x mu to x mu over x squared. OK? That has the property that it maps the unit ball outside the unit ball and vice versa. You can check that. That's very easy. And you can see that it's not connected to the identity because it maps the origin to a faraway point. Okay, that's not something that an infinitesimal transformation would do. First, it's a Z2 transformation. So these were continuous, right? These parameters are continuous. You can check. Well, it's easy to see that I square is 1. If I act on it twice, I go back to myself. And 3, it reverses the orientation of space-time. Do people know what these words mean? Do you know another transformation that has that property?
Like complex conjugation or something? Like Z and I do like Z bar, it also like,
I mean, it's called parity. Parity. There's like in four dimensions or any dimension, you always have a transformation where you reverse one of the coordinates. That's called parity. You have heard of the CPT theorem? That's that P. Okay. And by the way, you can check that this is the case. If you want, you can try to think how would you prove that this transformation reverses parity. I don't want to say it, but you can think about it. And you can, if you don't know, you can ask me next time. And one important thing is that unlike this symmetry, these transformations that must be a symmetry of any CFT, this need not be a symmetry of a CFT, just like parity is not a symmetry of a relativistic quantum field theory. But the reason I'm talking about it is that it actually is useful in doing some computations. And in particular, the conformal algebra you can essentially generate by starting with translations and inversions. Because so inversion is not necessarily a symmetry, but if I do it twice, it is a symmetry because I reverse the orientation twice. So you can convince yourself by knowing how x mu acts in this way, and you know the vector field here. You can finally check that if you do the double inversion of translation, you get k mu. Essentially, I exchanges p mu and k mu. It preserves Lorentz rotations. Oh, I'm running out of space, but hopefully you see it. And it acts on d hat by reverses the sign. Physically, what this means is that dilatation, it maps a dilatation that dilatates you outwards to one that dilatates you inwards. Okay, and you can straightforwardly check this just by acting on the vector fields. This is also very useful, by the way, to derive the finite form of the transformation. So I think you're all familiar with the finite form of the transformations for P, M, mu, and D, but not necessarily for K, right? I just gave you the infinitesimal one. So how would you find the finite one? Well, I already told you that for anything that's connected to the identity, you can get to the finite transformation by integrating the finite one. But a much simpler way to do it is to do this exercise. So do I P mu I. And do I let you derive it or I do it myself? Okay. Okay, do you want to do it? Yeah, okay. Let me just write it, and if you want, we can. No, okay, let me do it because I don't remember it, and okay, let's see. You may need to help me. So I act on P mu on X mu divided by X squared, right? First, I act with I on X mu, right? So the first time I get this, now I do a translation by a quantity A mu. So it's going to be I acting on x mu over x squared plus a mu. Okay? And now I have to invert this and not make a mistake, which will be non-trivial. So it's x mu divided by x squared plus a mu divided by this mass square. Okay? So now I can take this. So let me multiply and divide by x squared. So upstairs, I'm going to get x mu plus a mu, x squared. And downstairs, I'm going to get, so if I square these, this guy square. I get 1 over x squared, right? Plus 2a dot x divided by x squared, right? Plus a squared. And now I'll do something that you're not allowed to do in life, but I'm allowed to do it, so which is do this. I'm going to multiply everything by x squared. So I get a 1 here. I get. So this is the finite transformation. And you see that now if you expand this for a small a, you get precisely that, except that a is b. But okay, you get this minus 2a business comes from expanding the denominator here.
Yeah, it's not like you're acting on p mu, but it's more like exponent of a mu p mu, right? It's like
finite. Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is a finite transformation.
Okay, so it's just not like correct formula.
You want me to write an exponential?
Yeah, I mean, it's,
okay.
It's more.
See, he's a mathematician. Okay, let me.
Yeah, sorry.
Notice that this also makes manifest that inversion has the property that it can map a point to infinity because this denominator can vanish somewhere, okay? This will be useful later. Okay, so and now the last thing I want to say is that, so we discussed about the Lie algebra and this inversion, is that now we can talk about the conformal group. I'll be very brief here because that's kind of, so again, I don't know how to write. So the conformal group is called SO2, D, but it's a group. I don't know how. And just like the Lorentz group has four components, has four disconnected components, this guy has also four disconnected components. There is the connected component, and essentially the four components are determined by the determinant. So you take your transformation written as a SO2, D matrix, and you have these blocks of two time like blocks and d space like blocks, and you look at the determinant of that matrix for the 2 by 2 block and the d by d block. The four components are determined by the sign of the determinant, so you can have four choices. This block, the 2 by 2 block, can either be plus or minus, and this d by d block can be plus and minus. And then you can try to think about the ones that you know and love, you should know where they sit. So parity and t, you should find in which component of these four components it sits. And the thing that's slightly non-trivial to check, but it's true, is that inversion should be here, right? It's a discrete conformal transformation. What you can show is that inversion is conjugate, which means an inversion transformation is conjugate to parity, which is not that surprising because I said that parity reserves space-time orientation. Essentially, what it means is that if you represent I and P as a matrix, the two are related by a SO2D matrix which is in the connected component. Okay, so if your theory breaks P, it definitely breaks I and vice versa. Okay. Yeah, so let me not say more things for now about that. Okay, so now what I want to do is to understand what all this stuff has to do with physics and what consequences it has, okay? So the first object that we will discuss and that we already had a problem about is the statement, is the property of the energy momentum tensor. So essentially, we will start with that in any local quantum field theory, has a canonical operator. Which is the energy momentum tensor, okay? And essentially, we can try to understand what the consequences of the symmetries are on the energy momentum tensor. So we know if the theory is translational invariant. So let's start with Poincaré. It tells you that the energy momentum tensor is conserved on shell. When you have Lorentz invariance, Lorentz symmetry, it tells you that you can always make the energy momentum tensor to be symmetric. Okay? By the way, and this is Noether's theorem, right? The statement that translations imply the existence of a conserved current, which is the energy momentum tensor. Okay. Okay, now we want to see what other consequences the additional symmetries has on the energy momentum tensor. Okay. So actually, for that we will use actually something that I'll try to give you a kind of a simple way to think about it. So let's ask what happens to your theory if I make an infinitesimal diffeomorphism. Okay. So you know that this guy is I'll be in flat space. Let me do it in flat space so not to complicate things. Now, if the diffeomorphism is an actual conformal transformation, we can use the conformal Killing vector equations and replace this by 2 over d eta mu no, the divergence of psi, right? So what we find is that delta s, the factors, let's not worry about the overall factors, is essentially the space-time integral of t mu nu, the trace of, okay, t mu mu, so by this I mean the trace of the energy momentum tensor, times the divergence of the conformal transformation. So in order for the transformation to be a symmetry, this has to vanish, right? That's what a symmetry is, it is the action invariant. So from that we should be able to deduce what constraints exist on this canonical operator for the additional symmetries. So if we impose a scale invariance, what does this tell us about what T mu mu is?
Zero.
Sorry?
Zero.
This is a weaker thing you can say. The total derivative. And now let's do a conformal transformation, special conformal transformation, sorry. So now this zeta vector field is quadratic in the coordinates, right? So if we play the same idea of integrating by parts, now in order for it to vanish, it has to be a double derivative. So it tells you that t mu mu is the second derivative of some operator. Okay. And for example, I think the exercises you saw that theories that are conformal invariant had this property, right? That the trace of the energy momentum tensor did not vanish, but it definitely had this form. But this is the general result that any conformal fluid theory, the trace of the energy momentum tensor has to satisfy these properties. Now there's something else you can say about this. I don't know if you've seen this, but so whenever you have a current in Noether's theorem, then the current is not unique. You can always add to the current what are called improvement transformations. So these are additional terms that you can write down to the current that make it automatically conserved. Okay, and then you can use that to if you wish, to improve your energy momentum tensor so it has or currents to have some desired property. So for example, let me give an example just in usual, like for a flavor symmetry. I can define an improvement transformation like J mu to be J mu tilde. So this is conserved. And now I define the improved current to be defined as the derivative of an operator O that's antisymmetric in mu nu here. Now you see that that this guy is automatically conserved by virtue of the fact that you have this, the derivatives are symmetric, but this guy is antisymmetric. And notice the charge associated to J0 and the charge associated to J0 tilde is the same. Okay? So now, so Q equals Q tilde. So I think essentially it's something that you already seen in the exercises. What I want to claim is that it is always possible to improve T mu nu such that, so T mu nu to say, let's call it T mu nu hat, such that you can make the trace of the hatted operator to be zero in a conformal field theory. So another way of saying it is that a theory has is invariant under special conformal transformations if you can construct a conserved energy momentum tensor that's traceless. You may have to find an improvement transformation. And actually, I think it was one of the exercises, it's a nice exercise to prove there is a canonical way. So if you compute, if in your theory you have an energy momentum tensor that satisfies this trace condition, you can, there's a canonical way to improve it that this is the case. I don't know if I should say, if I should tell you how to do it, or you want me to tell you how to do it, or you think, I think in one of the exercises you were asked to couple to a curvature and so on. So I'll say it in words so I don't write things. So the best way, and this is not the way textbooks do it, but textbooks do many terrible things. The way you should think about improvement transformations is not by just being very clever and trying to write down some object that will have all the properties that are automatically conserved. The way you should do it is the following, is that every current, is associated to a global symmetry. So there is a canonical way to couple any conserved current to a background field that couples to that current. So for example, for that guy, okay, can someone tell me what is the external Gates field that couples to J mu?
Some A mu.
A mu, yeah. So, and what is the current? One way to think about the conserved current of the system is that you take your theory and you do the functional derivative with respect to the A mu. So J mu is delta L delta A mu, almost by definition, okay? So then the way you can improve in a canonical way that you just write down the most general thing you can write down and not have to guess, be clever about this, have I missed a possible improvement term or not, is you write down the most general term, local term in the action that has the following property. Because at the end of the day, I set a mu to zero. I take the functional derivative and then I put it to zero, right? So what you have to do is you have to write down the most general term that you can construct out of the background Gates field that's linear in the A's. If it were higher than linear in the A's, it wouldn't contribute because at the end of the day, we put that to zero. So what is the most general thing I can write down? I can write f mu nu, right? It's linear in A. But now this doesn't make sense because it's not Lorentz invariant. So I couple it, but I can couple it to an operator O mu nu, okay? And now if you do the functional derivative of this guy with respect to A mu, in the presence of this guy, you get precisely that, okay? So we've derived the improvement transformation by writing the most general coupling that's linear in the background field that will survive the variation. Okay. Likewise, for the energy momentum tensor, you can ask the same thing. So the energy momentum tensor, what is the background Gates field that couples to the energy momentum tensor? The metric, yeah. So what? So okay. Question. So what would be the analog of the of this object? In what is the most general coupling that's linear in the metric that you can write down? One step before. Riemann tensor. Because the Riemann tensor has the property that is linear in the fluctuation. And it's more general than the Ricci scalar, or the Ricci tensor, right, because you contract some indices. So the analog of this term would be to write down r mu nu rho sigma times some operator r mu nu rho sigma. So if you if you look at the books and you try to look at what is the more general improvement transformation, you will see that if you take delta, if you take the first variation of the Riemann tensor with respect to the metric, and then evaluate it in flat space. So what you do, you're going to vary this with respect to the metric, and then put the metric to be, the analog of that would be to put the metric in flat space, the Minkowski metric. You will derive the analog of this, okay? And then if you do that, you can always do this. You can write a coupling to the curvature such that the energy momentum tensor is traceless. Yeah, you look unhappy, yeah.
Yeah, I still have to somehow construct the O's, right? So I'm not sure how practical is this.
No, O is, I'm just doing effective field theory. I'm writing the most general thing that it could happen. So for example, in the example that you look at lambda phi to the 4, so I gave you an abstract argument. So here I told you, I haven't told you what Elmino is here, right? But I'm telling you that by using these ideas, I can write down a coupling of the Ricci Riemann tensor to Elmino to guarantee that I can turn that mess into this beautiful thing. And the Elmino will depend on your theory, but I don't care because if you have an Elmino, I'll write down the coupling. And in the lambda phi to the 4, there was an example of that, right? You had some I forget what it was. So T mu mu was not on the node zero, was the second derivative of something. So yeah.
Can you maybe explain one more time how scaling variance implies this constraint and special conformal transformation implies the other constraint? Because I think.
Okay, so let's see. So let's look at this. Mm-hmm. So zeta is linear in the coordinate, right?
Yes.
So I have that the integral of t mu mu is zero.
So you have that.
If I say I want my theory to be invariant at scale transformations. I have to impose that the integral over all space-time of t mu mu is zero.
Yes.
So it tells you that t mu mu is a total derivative. The strongest constraint is that t mu mu is a total derivative. And this guy is exactly the same logic, except that.
I see.
You see? Okay. So for example, now imagine I gave you a theory. Let's try to use some physical intuition. So imagine I give you a theory that you have an operator that breaks the scale invariance, or conformal invariance. So imagine I write a mass term, like the mass. So can someone guess what you're gonna, when you evaluate the trace of the energy momentum density, you're gonna get here?
Something proportional to mass.
You're gonna get exactly the operator that breaks it. So you're gonna get exactly 1/2 m squared phi squared. More interestingly, if you're in Young-Mills theory, in Young-Mills theory, the trace of the energy momentum tensor vanishes classically, but not quantum mechanically. So there, the trace of the energy momentum tensor in the quantum theory will be precisely the beta function of the Gates coupling times the trace of F mu nu square. So the trace of the energy momentum tensor essentially diagnoses the operators that break the conformal symmetry. Okay, good. Oof. So we discussed an operator that definitely exists in any CFT, which is the energy momentum tensor. But of course, interesting CFTs have all other kinds of operators. I want to now understand how conformal symmetry is realized on those operators. Okay. So let's discuss a little bit operators in a CFT. So this will be, if you wish, just a bit of a generalization of things that you know of how operators or fields are represented in a Lorentz invariant theory, how Lorentz invariant is represented on operators and fields. Now we have to understand how conformal symmetry is represented on operators and fields. So the main thing is that, of course, is that they have to be in representations. Of the conformal algebra. Okay. So there is a kinematical part, a part of the, essentially there are two labels in a field. There are the internal quantum numbers, and then there is the space-time dependence, right? So in a Lorentz invariant theory, the internal quantum number is the Lorentz spin, right? So now we have to understand what is the analog of the Lorentz spin here, okay? So what I'm going to say is that operators are labeled, so they're labeled by two things. One is the eigenvalues under mu, which is the Lorentz spin. So now how we, but we're not done here, because now we have other generators, right? We have other generators, and there are many ways of saying this. Let me say it in a way that hopefully sounds plausible. The way you fully characterize your system is by looking at the eigenvalues under the maximally commuting set of operators, okay? So what other operator commutes with M, you know?
D.
D. So we have to also give eigenvalues under D hat. And this is, we called it scaling. So we call this, if you wish, S. And we call this delta, which is the scaling dimension. So any operator in a conformal field theory has a well-defined Lorentz spin and a well-defined scaling dimension. So we have to carry around this extra label because we have an extra symmetry. And we have to tell how your operators transform under that symmetry. And that's characterized, just like Lorentz spins tells you under Lorentz, delta tells you under scaling. Now, one thing that's very important in a conformal field theory that operators, essentially, there exist two classes of operators with respect to this representation theory. Which are called primary. And these transform, and we will discuss them, this transform as tensors under conformal transformations. And then you have what's called descendants. So every descendant operator is the child of a primary, okay? And even though they don't transform as nicely as the primary ones, but their properties are completely fixed by the primary, okay? So transformation properties fixed completely by they're primary. So I'm going to now construct the representation more concretely, so it doesn't sound so crazy. Okay. I can do it here. So let's try to understand this. I make an analogy with the representation theories of SU2 that you're familiar with. So one of the things that we have to do in a conformal field theory is to label operators by the maximal commuting set, and in particular the dilatation operator. So what does it mean that an operator has a scaling dimension delta? It tells you that the commutator of the dilatation operator with O is delta O, right? Now, what operator can I construct from O using the conformal symmetry? I can act on O with P mu and K mu, right? Or K mu, or both, actually. So, but let's see what happens to that under the dilatation operator. So imagine I want to do the commutator of the following operator, which is the commutator of P mu with O. This can be computed by knowing the commutator of D with P mu, right? Which we did in the previous lecture. And I already told you that I focused your attention that D with respect to mu acted like a raising operator, okay? So you can do it more carefully. You can use, how is this called? The Jacobi identity to move this object into the action of D here and the commutator of P here, okay? And what we're gonna get is delta plus one or hat. So this has increased the dimension. Now if I do the same thing with K mu, it lowers the dimension, right? It's the lowering operator, okay? So what we find here is that P mu increases delta and K mu decreases delta, okay? So if you wish, that's the idea. So now, in this language, it will be very, yes?
Is there a mu index somewhere on the right-hand side, or is that in, like, the argument of O?
It should be the operator itself, right? Sorry, I wrote it wrong. Yeah, it's like this. You're right. Thank you. I mean, I'm saying that P mu O, K mu O are eigenvectors of D with eigenvalue increased by that. So the primary operator if you wish is the lowest energy state in a family. So it's the operator that sits at the bottom. So it's the operator that's killed by K mu O, okay? If you're familiar with this language from group theory, it's the lowest weight state, okay? For example, in the study of angular momentum of SU2, you have a representation that has spin J, you have two J plus one values. J minus lowers the azimuthal component, right? From J to J minus one and so on. And then there is the lowest weight state, which is when M equals minus J. This is exactly the analog of that. It kills the lowest weight state. So then the representation, any representation of the conformal algebra looks in this way. You have O, and now you can build it by acting, so this is the primary. So I can act on it now with arbitrary, I'm not gonna write the commutator because it's annoying, but when I say P mu acting on O, you should think of it as a commutator, but So this has dimension d, this has dimension delta plus 1, has dimension delta plus 2, and this goes on forever. Okay? So a representation of the conformal algebra is infinite dimensional. And that's not surprising because the conformal group is non-compact. Okay. Good. Any questions about this? And of course, I don't tell you about anything about spin because you know everything about spin already. Yes.
So is the delta for the lowest for the primary operator always 1 because it has to, you subtract 1 and it goes to 0?
No, it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be 1. No.
So it has the property that you wrote that if you commute k with it, that it equals 0.
No, it just tells you. No, the lowest state doesn't have to be 0. It can be in some. Just tells you that you have a family. So I act in a CFT. Okay, a CFT is essentially determined, or is a part of the data is determined by the complete list of the spectrum of dimensions of the bottom operators, and this will be some number. So it will be delta 1, delta 2, delta 3. All of and they are whatever numbers they are. In general, actually, we don't know what these numbers are. All that we know is that the operator that has the dimension is killed by k. That you cannot go below this one. It doesn't have to be 0. I don't know why you think it has to be 0.
Well, because
it's just that you have O, and you say, can I construct an operator that has a smaller dimension in the family? And the answer is no, because k mu acting on it would lower it.
Yeah. It looks like what you've written though is like a mechanism for raising the dimension by 1 or lowering it by 1.
Yeah. So, but the bottom the actual dimension of the primary doesn't have to be an integer. I mean, it increases by 1 always, but the actual dimension of the operator doesn't have to be 1. For example, in the Ising CFT, it's 0.5 whatever, some complicated thing. The thing that we are compared to SU2 is that in SU2, you know, J is a half or an integer, right? They have a very simple properties, the rational numbers. Here, it doesn't have to be a rational number in general. But it still has the property that it's the lowest delta state.
So the spectrum always is like the weight of the scaling dimension of the primary operator and then plus one.
Yes.
Plus one.
Yes.
But then you can have different operators with different.
Yes. Yes. So you have, so the list of data you have to give me the list of all your primary operators with all your deltas. Actually, in two dimensions, okay, so above two dimensions, you can prove that the number of primary operators is actually infinite. So it's not a finite list to begin with. In two dimensions, there are exceptions because you have more symmetry. Actually, you can have a conformal field theory which has a finite number of primaries. They're called the minimal models. But in general, you have an infinite family of primaries. And of course, on top of that, a super infinite family of descendants. Yeah. The thing that's remarkable at CFTs is that the properties of these guys are completely fixed by symmetry, by the properties of the guy upstairs. And that's intuitive to understand because I constructed the family by acting with P mu. But P mu acts on the operator how? By a derivative, right? So if you know everything about a correlation function of a primary, you know it of the descendants, but just by taking stupid derivatives, essentially.
So wait, so like I have to fix my primaries in the theory.
Fix? I don't know what that means. You have to fix.
You said I have to take my primaries.
The theory has a correlation of primaries, yes.
Okay, but like, so if I okay, let's assume we have Lagrangian. So how do I read out my primaries from the Lagrangian? I know scale dimensions right away of all the operators.
Yes. Yeah, so you're going to see now because you know who's a primary by the way they transform under conformal transformations.
Yes, so there's the equation, right?
That's one equation, yeah. But more generally, imagine you know the transformation. I'm going to write it right now exactly how primary operators transform under conformal transformations. Yeah. This is exactly what I'm going to discuss now. So now Just like for Lorentz transformations, we have to represent the Lorentz group on the fields or the operators. Now we have to do the same thing for conformal transformations. So let me just remind you what we did here. Let me use this notation. G is a group element, okay? That is labeled, if you wish, G is a function of all those parameters, A, lambda, W, and B, okay? So now I have an operator of dimension. So now every, so let's look at primaries. So it has two quantum numbers, as I said. So A is the Lorentz spin. So this I will not say much more about because you're familiar with. And this guy is the scaling dimension. So now imagine, okay, so maybe you can help me a little bit. Imagine I did a Lorentz transformation. How would this transform under Lorentz transformation?
I have to like have some representation matrix, right? So
that acts on this index, right? Yeah. But now, remember that in the first one of the lectures, I said that you can think of a conformal transformation as a local Lorentz. I defined that matrix R, if you remember. So let me remind you again. So there is this matrix R, mu null. Remember? That had the property that R transpose eta R equals eta. This was this local Lorentz transformation. So in a conformal field theory, you're going to have what you're saying. So it's going to act like this. So I'm leaving space for things that I still have to write. So if this was just standard Lorentz transformation, you would have, this would be a representation of the Lorentz group. It would depend if it's the vector representation, the tensor representation, the spinor representation. But if for the Lorentz case, you would have here the constant Lorentz transformation you did. For a conformal field theory, you have to plug in this R, which in general is X dependent, okay? Now, how does it, okay. One thing that's important that hopefully you know is that the way, so the Lorentz groups acts, any space-time transformation acts on the Lorentz quantum, on the internal quantum numbers, the labels of the operator, and on space-time. And it's very important that it acts on space-time in the opposite order, in the opposite direction that it acts on. Do you understand that, why that's the case? Or think about it, and you can tell me an example. In short, you want, the whole point is that we're trying to construct a transformation that realizes the symmetry that you want. And in order for the product of two transformations to also be a symmetry, these L's have to be a homomorphism of that symmetry. And these things have to be in this order so that the group elements multiply in the right order, okay? And now, this was essentially the information about Lorentz quantum number. The information about the scaling dimension enters in this Jacobian. Okay, D, okay, this D is the space-time dimension. I think I was consistent with putting D hat. So D is the space-time dimension, and delta is the eigenvalue, okay? So actually, this is a very natural transformation. This is actually how a tensor in general relativity would transform, a density. You know what a density is? So a density is something that transforms under some as a tensor, but with some non-trivial Jacobian. And the power of the Jacobian has to do with the dimension of the operator. And now you can try to do the exercise that this transformation concatenates properly. So if I make two of them, I have a homomorphism. Or you can then also do the infinitesimal transformation. So let's do the infinitesimal one. So now let's do an infinitesimal transformation. So let's do x tilde is x plus zeta. And now all that I do is I linearize that thing, right? I replace, I linearize the transformation. And then what I get is the variation of the operator, a delta of x, which is o tilde of x minus o a of x, has an orbital part that has to do with how the operator acts on the special on the coordinate dependence of the operator, which is acts like this. And then I have like the spin part. Let me write and then I'll comment. Plus, minus, according to this. I guess I should put delta everywhere, sorry. Where this omega mu nu is the local Lorentz rotation. So it's omega mu nu, but now it has a correction that comes from the fact that a special conformal transformation, as I said, generates a local rotation. This follows from this. And then you have a local dilatation. And all the symbols here, I think you know what they are. So this is the usual just geometric action on the operator, just shifts it, so I have to take a derivative. This is a Lorentz rotation. These M nu are just matrices for the Lorentz group in that representation. This is the strength of the Lorentz transformation, which has a Lorentz piece, a pure Lorentz piece, but a part that's induced by the special conformal transformation. And then I have just a silly local dilatation, right? Just O is just rescaled, but with the caveat that you have a constant dilatation, a constant scale transformation, but also one exact dependence induced by the special conformal transformation. And now, if you wish, you can convince yourself. So how would you check that this is a proper transformation, a representation of the conformal algebra? What you would do is you would take the commutator, you take two transformations. C1, C2. You should check that this is true. So zeta 1 and zeta 2 are two arbitrary conformal infinitesimal conformal transformations. We know that this is the commutator of two vector fields. These are yet another conformal transformation. And the commutator of this transformation, I forgot a note here, closes. Okay? Well, I'm almost out of time. Notice now that what do you want to say? Yes.
I'm just a bit confused. So don't I have two operators on the left-hand side? So how do I?
Sorry, I meant this. Sorry, you have two consecutive transformation acting on O. Yeah, I read wrong. This means another way to think about it is the following: is that I'm going back a little bit to try to give you more intuition of why. Kind of primary operators and the eigenvalues and their m mu nu and d hat is important. So for example, one way to think about why in relativistic quantum field theory it is sufficient to know the transformation of the operator under all symmetries if you know it at the origin. Why? Because if you know how it transforms at the origin, I can induce the transformation at any other point by moving it away from the origin is conjugating the operator by translations, right? And if I act with the symmetry, I can just commute through and find the answer. The same is true for a conformal field theory, for conformal transformations. So notice that in let's think about first Lorentz. Which are the transformations that leave the origin invariant?
Rotations.
So that's why, in order to specify the quantum numbers of the transformations, I only need to focus on the quantum numbers under the operator that fixes the origin, okay? Which is MNU, because once I know the transformation at the origin, I know it anywhere by commuting operators, okay? Now let's do the same exercise for conformal transformations. Again, is it obvious that if I know the conformal transformation of a field at the origin, I know it everywhere? I do, because I know the commutator of everyone with P mu, so I can just commute through. So which are the transformations that preserve the origin? And another one. Look at the transformation. A primary operator is an operator, you can say it is an operator that is left invariant, is invariant at the origin, when it's at the origin. Okay, so now a descendant. What about the descendants? Well, the descendants will be easy to find out. If you know the transformation of O, you definitely know how to derive the transformation of derivatives of O. But since you see that these parameters have X's in them, it may include members upper in the family. So it doesn't transform it maps. So if I do, for example, the transformation of this guy under a special conformal transformation, I will not only get operators here, I will get people up and down the family, okay? Good, so let me try to just finish with, so this was, in a sense, just telling you how in a conformal field theory, operators are, the conformal algebra is represented, and what are the quantum numbers. Now, how do we extract the physics out of this? And that's where we're gonna start seeing the miracles that conformal symmetry buys you, okay? So what I want to do is now constraint observables. I'm saying that a special conformal transformation annihilates a primary operator at the origin. But notice not if it's away from the origin. Mm-hmm. Now I'll make a statement that should be surprising. I want to say that the position dependence of the 2 and 3 point functions is completely fixed. So that's already like a little miracle. See, how much time do I have?
It's 15 minutes now, 16.
So maybe I should stop here, but why don't I ask you to do the following? Before the first class, I can do it in the next class. But essentially, the things I want to argue is that, so maybe a little bit, so at least to start something. So imagine I look at a two-point function. Imagine I tell you that you're in a relativistic quantum field theory. What do you know about the position dependence of this correlation function? Is there something that you've thought about? So how will it look like? Okay, it will be a function of the difference. But we know nothing about this function, right? What we will see next time is that in a conformal field theory, so you have right now, just to simplify things, I'm considering O's to be Lorentz scalars, not to have indices floating all over the place. But it's exactly the same idea. The position dependence is completely fixed. So imagine I put here operator of delta 1, dimension delta 1, operator dimension delta 2. First, they're orthogonal. So operators with different dimensions are orthogonal. So that the two-point function has a delta 1, delta 2. And then you have a constant here, C, that you have to determine. Okay. So in a conformal field theory, the position dependence is completely fixed. You only have one number to compute, which is this C. Okay. And for a three-point function, it's still true. So now you have a structure constant. This will play a close analog to the structure constants of Lie algebra. Even the three-point function, the position dependence is completely fixed. Notice that this is quite well, because if I give you 3 points, you could write, and I don't tell you anything more than Lorentz invariant, Poincaré invariance. You could have arbitrary functions of all kinds of different things, right? But here, we can show that it depends on, so, but this x1, 2, I mean x1 minus x2, okay? And it's delta 1 plus delta 2 minus delta 3. And I have 2, 3, delta 2, plus delta 3 minus delta 1, and x 1 3, delta 1 plus delta 3 minus delta 2. And this just follows from imposing the symmetries. So there are many ways of deriving this, but just given what I told you here, if you know, are you familiar with the word identity? So if you use the word identities suitably, you'll be able to derive this. There is an intuitive way of explaining why the 2 and the 3-point function, but by the way, that stops here. You could imagine, is the 4-point function the position dependence fixed? That's not the case anymore. And actually, it would be a good exercise for you to think of a kinematical reason why conformal symmetry actually fixes this to be this. It's completely fixed as opposed to the general theory. So what does a special conformal and dilatation have that allow you to fix the position dependence here, but not in a general theory that does not have that symmetry? Yeah, I guess I have to stop. Any questions before? Yeah, this was.
So this theory is only non-conformally anomalous theories, right? So so just three-level conformal invariance is not enough.
No.
Yeah. So like super invariance and like Ising and those kind of stuff.
So yes. No, it has to be an honest to what CFT. Yeah.
Okay. So we had this split between primary and descended operators, but aren't there also like operators which are not primary but are not derivatives of other primaries?
I mean, what are those? The ones that you work with Lorentz spin or something?
Because I remember that I can like cook up in like PC goes CFT, I can cook up.
And
stuff like that.
So here, all this is the assumption of a unitary CFT.
Okay.
I didn't discuss much, but. Yeah, if you allow in the world of non-unitary things, there are other things that can happen, but I'm avoiding those for now. All right, so I guess the last part maybe was a bit too fast, but I will start next time. Well, so think about what I said here. check this if you want. Check both, that this is the right thing to do so that you have a homomorphism, so you have a good action on the operators. And also, if you want, you can check this so that this is a good transformation. Yeah, there are people waiting outside, so thank you.